Hello, and welcome to Peter's Podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. I'm here today in the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. So you may hear some crickets, you may hear some birds, you may hear some bees. And I wish it were a scent podcast because I'm sitting in the middle of something that's somewhat reminiscent of honeysuckle. It's quite delicious. But you'll just have to come yourself. The Botanic Garden is in the southern part of Brooklyn, near Prospect Park, right near the Grand Army Plaza, and right near where Peter and Wendy live. So next time you're coming for a visit, you can check it out. But I'm sitting on the Brooklyn Celebrity Walk, and it's a little tribute to many of the creative people who've come from Brooklyn. So I'm sitting with a little plaque to Arthur Miller, one to Carl Sagan, two people I like. And then there's a host of musicians. Harry Chapin is right in front of me here. And a number of actresses. Rita Hayworth, who my father's generation worshipped. And a whole bunch of other very talented people. So hopefully it'll be inspiring for me and a little bit inspiring for you as well. So there we are. So as many of you know, I just got back from a retreat. And on this retreat, I got to talk to some people I didn't know, people who are now friends and students and fellow explorers. And one of the things I noticed when I did that was that they didn't know much about me, especially since our retreat focused on creativity. They didn't know anything about what I had created. So I thought I would spend a little bit of time today talking about my creative work as a writer. All of the three of us who led the retreat, Ulrika and Wendy and I, write. We write both nonfiction and fiction. And it's been a really important part of what I've been doing my whole life, actually. I've always felt like a writer. I always tried to write different things. And so I thought I would talk a little bit about my process, why I write, how I write, and then fill in a little bit on what I've written. So for the first part, why I write, I'm hoping that why, for me, is maybe an inspiration to you. I'm not trying to teach you my process. There are plenty of books out there that will do that, where somebody's having a good go at things and they say, hey, I know how to do it. Here's how you do it. You do it like me. And I think that's a little bit misguided from a teaching perspective. But I would like to let you know what I do, and maybe you'll be able to find from that something that you can use. So for the longest time, I was just like any normal human being, being a human being, and had all the problems that human beings have, which I still continue to have because I'm still a human being. But what I found early on was this love of music. I was, from the time I was a kid, really into singing. I played a couple instruments. And I fell in love with popular music. I fell in love with the music my parents listened to, which was much more along the lines of what was popular in the 40s. And so I started writing songs. And the songwriting was a way to put some perspective around the emotions I was feeling. Some people do this like with a journal, but it was very cool for me to have this format of a song, because I could write in a kind of an idealistic way, you know. So the songs that I wrote over the 40 years of my music career, you know, were able to like feel an emotion and let that emotion have its day you know, so that sort of embarrassment that you feel when you're in love with someone but you're not sure they feel the same way, you know, I was able to write a song called Don't Make Me Be a Fool, you know. That heartbreak that you have that's just devastating when you have a breakup, I was able to say, let me forget you. So, you know, it was just a way to process stuff and let it rip. So some of the songs were great, some of the songs were lousy, but it was at least a chance to process something. And, you know, as a creative person, you kind of fall in love with the things that you make. Whether you're creative in the kitchen, or you're creative at an instrument, or you're creative on a canvas, or you're creative in the boardroom, you know, you make this thing, and it's kind of our nature to do that. And so the thing that we were working with, the raw material, the emotion, all of those kinds of things, they serve their purpose to allow us to do the creating, and then we kind of fall in love with the creation and it becomes its own thing. So, you know, when you go to a concert and you're listening to, I don't know, Chris Isaak or whoever you listen to in your own generation, and you're listening to something about a heartbreak, you can be pretty sure that heartbreak isn't still there, but the thing itself is now its own entity and it's alive, and the person can still get great reward from presenting it. You know, the co-creation aspect. Cool. So that was the music component. So when it comes to writing things on paper, words, obviously songwriting is a way. And after a whole lot of songwriting, I got intrigued with playwriting, and I wrote a play. I wrote an opera when I was singing as my major pursuit, and then I got intrigued with films, which I'd always enjoyed watching, but I thought, wow, man, I have an idea that would make a cool movie. So I tried to write a screenplay. I'd written screenplay for a TV show once before, and just kind of went with that. And then I was in a moment where I was spending a lot of time like staying in one place. I couldn't leave where I was, and I had a lot of free time on my hands, and I had this idea that I thought I was going to write as a screenplay, and I thought, you know what, it would be cool to sort of play this out a little more in depth, where rather than the actors getting to do the fleshing out, I would maybe be able to do that myself if I wrote it as a novel. So I started to do that, and I wrote a novel, and it was really pleasant and very cathartic. So sort of like with the songs and that ability to play out some emotions, I got a chance with fiction writing to make some space around things that I had been feeling, things from the past that I was so certain of at the time that were going to be important. If only this could have happened, you know, if only I could have done it this way, then things would be different. So the beauty of a novel is you create the whole world, and certainly this is true of short stories or any kind of fiction writing. You're creating the world that the story takes place in. You're creating the action that's going to take place. You're basically God. You know, so I explored some of the stuff that was going on for me through this novel, and I found the process very rewarding. And like with the songs, those creations that you're in love with, I also found that I loved the output of the work. I enjoyed very much having this world that I had created to go back to and read through and flip through and smile at the characters who were basically flowing from me but also flowing through me in a way. You know, they came to me and I got to enjoy the possibilities that they provided. And the first novel I wrote had some basis in my own history, you know, but all of the characters were composites, or there was, you know, somebody portraying the characteristics of somebody I knew, but they looked nothing like this person, or they weren't in that role in a family, etc. So they were all just really unique beings who I was using somebody I knew as a kind of a mannequin for them. So that gave me some characteristics to work with, and some of the circumstances were certainly things that I had dealt with or challenges I had dealt with, and people who were very close to me said, oh my God, this was like your life, you know, and yet it wasn't my life at all. I kept the plot organized so that it wasn't me, but then again, it was me, you know, and I think any author would probably admit that there's a fair amount of herself or himself in what they're writing. But the whole point of writing nonfiction, or writing fiction rather, is that you get to change anything you want. So you're not restricted by that. So the first book I wrote was called Wally and Collie, and it was about a person kind of like me, but somebody who was like finding their way, and somebody who was finding yoga. And so I got to explore a little bit some of the stuff in yoga that I'm intrigued with, how I got to look at what someone who is new to it, instead of me who has 30 years of experience when I was writing that, you know, what they would find, what they would feel, what they would think about. I got to explore some crazy relationships, some of the wackadoodle coincidences that come up, the notions of karma, which would again come forward in a big way in a future subsequent novel, and look at the characters. So in Wally and Collie, the book is primarily a love story, and it happens at the level not of like 20-somethings meeting, although there are 20-somethings meeting in it, but in a older group, like a middle-aged couple meeting, and some of the stuff they deal with. And then I got to explore, on top of that, yoga and the kind of craziness of tantra that gets talked about in the literature, the sort of magical aspect of things, and the weird gray area between regular life as we experience it in the walkabout world and the thing we do in meditation and the thing that happens in dreams, where we dream something and it seems completely real, but we wake up and we go, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened, right? So Wally and Collie got to be this sort of magical realism version of a love story that had yoga as that magical component, that this tantric teacher somehow infused the plot of the characters with an element of making them burst beyond their normal lives and resolve their problems in that way. So that was a really fun book to write. And then the next thing that I did was to work on a book that was a short book. And the idea came to me. The book was called The Black Hole of the Heart. The idea came to me when I was noticing how emotions seem to have a life of their own. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you know, you think that you are doing life, you think you are living, but in fact, Rajas and Tamas and Sattva are doing the living, and you are simply the consciousness of it. So I noticed that when one gets upset, especially, right, or when one falls in love, it tends to just take you over. And I had been thinking a lot about black holes and singularities, and this is a black hole a good metaphor for what happens in the Big Bang when we all come into being, but then there's this other thing when we go to meditation that's like a oneness. So the black hole was on my mind, and this thing of emotion sweeping you up, like you fall over an edge into it, got me. And so the black hole of the heart is three different stories that tie together in small ways, but in each case there's this element of the black hole and what it's doing. So one aspect of that is very scientific, because the protagonist is a scientist, a physicist, an astronomer. And the other is much more, again, in this magical realism kind of way, like things transpire that you could only call trance state or dream state. But I think a fair number of us have those kinds of experiences, and so I thought it was walking the line of at least feasibility, but it definitely dips into the magical realism side. Then the final one, again, touches on this aspect of yoga, like somebody who's having a real challenge in their life comes upon yoga as potential cure, as a potential tool to use. So the black hole of the heart is a very, like a short novel. So that's the next one that I wrote. Then the third novel that I wrote was one that is totally about karma. I got very intrigued with the idea of how do you visualize, or what's like the practical way of thinking about this whole reincarnation kind of a notion. So this book was called Incarnation. And in Incarnation, which is a bit of a puzzle in terms of its structure, I had notions of Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita. I once read an annotated version of Lolita, and I was like, thank God, because I had read it before, I had seen the film. But then as I read this annotated version, every single thing in the book had some double entendre or was a tie-in to something that had happened before. So reading it at that level was really quite amazing. And in Incarnation, it wasn't so much as I was being super tricky or anything like that from a formal place as a writer, say, but the plot was doing this little dance. In Incarnation, the premise is that the element of time that we're so wedded to in our day-to-day, that is this linear thing that progresses from birth to death, that this element of time is just a part of our, I'll call it a contract with the universe. The time is something that gets imposed on the infinity of the universe. Space is something that gets imposed on the infinity of the universe. Cause and effect, something that gets imposed on the universe. And anybody who's studied yoga deeply, maybe in a teacher training or something, will recognize the words I'm saying as the kanchukas. These are limitations that yogis consider put on the unbound everything that give it its form, that create this setting of a stage in which we live life. So these kanchukas include time, and time, though, is not an absolute, right? You step outside of time many times during your life. You do it when you're totally engrossed in something and you lose track of time and the time seems not to go anywhere. But even in a physical way, if you're at sea level and you've got an atomic clock, and you set that clock and it starts ticking, and then you also at the same moment you're on Mount Everest and you set an atomic clock, those two clocks will register time differently. Time is not a fixed element. So what I did in incarnation was I assumed that the progression of us in life is not through a life and then through another life and then through another life and then through another life, and requiring all these years, but that what would it be like if life were instead taking place always in every moment at the same quote-unquote time, which doesn't exist, right? So that's how it can be. So in my mind, I can conceive of five different plot lines for a potential short story. Those could all be in my mind at the same time. And in incarnation, that's exactly what takes place. So some of the philosophy about incarnation is that you learn something from a life, and then you bring that into your next life, and then you learn something from that life. And so all these lives are like a school or like a growing. And in my musings for incarnation, I was thinking that those learnings could take place almost simultaneously, that you're just growing from every choice you make. Every time you make a choice that you think is going to make things different, make things better, that what was going on wasn't good enough or wasn't okay, that it's not that it wasn't good enough or it's going to be better, it's just that it's a different choice. That these experiences have their purpose, whether you accept them or not. So that let me just say that again, because that's a sort of maybe fishy kind of thing to say, and I don't want it to be confused with you shouldn't want to change anything in the world, which is one of the major arguments to anything like fate or karma or any of those notions. So what I'm trying to say is we're driven through our inclination. The Sanskrit word for that is karma. We're driven through our karma to want to do certain things. And again, using these other metaphors, to learn certain things or to have certain things transpire. So that's a given. I wanted to make things. I wanted to create things. Right? Somebody else wants to heal people. Somebody else wants to earn lots of money and be really, really powerful. There's a book right now called, I forget what it's called, I'm going to write it in the show notes, but where there's this description of karma and past lives and what they're for and what they mean. It's kind of interesting to look at it from that way. But in incarnation, I went a different route. I thought, okay, so I'm going along, I'm who I am, I have these motivations and whatnot. So if I'm in a particular setting of life, certain people are going to have an impact on how things transpire, certain events are going to take place, those are going to have an impact on how things transpire, and I'm within that, I'm having the experience of living. If I'm more conscious about it, I might think about it. If I'm not so conscious about it, I'm just kind of going through the life. So in incarnation, I took some of these moments that we feel so critical about, like, oh my God, you know, should I ask her on a date? Oh my God, I want to kill myself. Oh my God, should I go to this college or should I skip college? You know, all these kinds of critical moments in our life. And I posited, what would happen if you chose the one instead of the other? And then I played out each of them. So that's where I say the book is a little bit like a puzzle, because you could go one way and this happens, you could go another way and that happens. If you've seen the movie Sliding Door, it's an example of that, right? The two lives go two different ways based on an incident. So in my playing out of these incidents, I have a handful of characters. One wants to be a writer, one is a journalist, one is in the theater or in movies. One is a hacker, like in the computer world, and has this thing about justice, and yet he's a criminal. And then there's some supporting characters along the way. I'm probably forgetting one of the important ones. So that's going on. And then those lives play. Oh, Krishna Anand is a computer programmer who he's in this thing about love and acceptance and family drama and things like that. So I forgot, like, the key player. Anyway, so all those characters are interacting, and every incarnation, somehow or other, it turns out that they're still interacting. So that book is probably the most elaborate from a premise perspective. But it gave me the opportunity, to go back to my original point, it gave me this opportunity to think about some of these big philosophical notions of yoga in a way that's utterly practical. Like, part of the book reads like a spy thriller, because ultimately any philosophy that we have has to describe life as we are experiencing it, life as we know it, or else it's just idealism. Yeah. So my book was a chance to think about all of the stuff that we go through and put it into a framework in which lives made sense, in which lives as we know it happens. So that was that book. So after incarnation, I took a little break from the philosophy, and I got kind of wrapped up in a thing about love. And it's so interesting because, and this is a little aside to myself, but I just started revisiting this book, which is called Love Song. And it's based on two people who are in love, and they're also in the same music business. So they're both trying to make it, quote unquote, in the music business, and they have this bizarre dynamic of being both competitive and supportive. So I finished what I thought was, you know, the book, and then I started shopping it for representation, and I didn't feel very pressured about, you know, getting it out. I didn't feel that urgent. So I let it sit for a while, and recently I decided to dive back in a little bit, and I've been letting one of the characters speak a little bit more, and that's opening up some interesting stuff. And perhaps what she's thinking about has something to do with why I wrote this in the first place, although the thought that I had in my head just went in and out, which is something about writing, you know, and maybe part of this process piece, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. But, you know, sometimes ideas come and go. Sometimes you have a dream, like in the nighttime, you know, you're dreaming and you're like, I had the most brilliant idea, and you can't remember what it is. You know, and that's just how it is. You know, our lives come and go. I spent quite a number of years focusing on visual arts as a graphic designer and as a photographer, an art photographer. And I used to come upon these places, or I would see a thing and I'd go, oh my God, that's such a perfect picture for somebody else. Like, it didn't grab me in the right way. And in the same way, I think there are these moments of inspiration where you think, oh my God, that's so for me, but then it escapes you And what can you do, you know? Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, among other books, wrote a book called Big Magic, and in Big Magic she tells a story that she's told a variety of places about having a whole plot in her head, starting a book, writing it, and then losing interest in a way, like having to put it aside and just sort of nothing happens. And then later talks to Ann Patchett, and Ann Patchett and she become friends, and Elizabeth Gilbert asks her, what are you working on? And Ann Patchett tells her, I'm working on this book, and this is the plot, and you know, it's like unbelievable. The plot is exactly the plot of the book Elizabeth Gilbert was working on and then lost interest in, or at least lost motivation or drive in. And Gilbert's theory is that the ideas have their own life. You know, they're just heading to wherever they need to go to get expressed. So that's kind of interesting. So I'm working on Love Song. When I thought Love Song was finished, I started working on another book that was more philosophical again, and much more about one of these yoga notions of where you go when you go into meditation, or that maybe another way to say that is that we have kind of guardian angels watching over us or informing us, or the book that I'm reading right now has this notion of you have helpers helping you out, and that's something in the Native American tradition very strongly, as well as and as well as other traditions. So in this book, which doesn't have a title as of yet, although it might be called The Reviewers, it's its working title, I have this notion of, you know, a part of you has some sense of what you're here for, what you're doing, what why you're in certain situations, why you need to make certain choices. So it's playing with that notion, and I'm sort of still struggling a little bit with what is the mechanism of that, how does that look. So actually the idea of Minority Report just popped into my head, where the people who have that sort of sixth sense about things are sort of viewing stuff on a screen all around them. That's kind of an image that I had in my head for my book that I'm working on. So there's that, right? So that's that. I want to thank everybody who is a sponsor of Peter's podcast on Patreon. Patreon is a cool crowdsourcing, crowdfunding site that I use to make it possible to have Peter's podcast without advertisements. So many of the podcasts I love to listen to stop right in the middle and sell me a mattress or sell me a watch or sell me some food service. I'm just like constantly fast forwarding through that stuff. I hope that I can avoid doing that in Peter's podcast, but it requires some funding from folks like you who enjoy this content and are willing to say, spend the price of a cappuccino on it, or even less. So if that's you, sounds like it's worth doing, please check it out, patreon.com/peterspodcast, and you can subscribe for any amount you like. Some of my sponsors are getting a session with me every month where we talk for an hour online, or getting a mantra from me, or just dropping a buck here and there to make it possible. You can always start, stop, or change the amount, so it's super easy. Thank you. patreon.com/peterspodcast. So I hope if you're interested, you'll pop over to amazon.com or to my website, peterfurco.com, and maybe you'd be interested in reading something that I wrote in the fiction realm. I also wrote a book called Yoga for Artists. Oh my God, this gorgeous monarch butterfly just flitted over to one of these beautiful smelling flowers. Hey, butterfly. It's Wendy's inspired animal lately, so I guess she's visiting the podcast. Uh, I also wrote a book called Yoga for Artists that is talking about how a yoga practice can be beneficial for a creative person. Somebody who read it a couple years back said, why do you call this for artists? This is like for anybody. So I'll throw that out there too. If you're not an artist, but you're looking for a sort of a primer on how yoga works, it's a slim book. I like slim books. I'm a succinct writer. So there's that. So check that out. And then I'm also at the very moment that we're speaking and listening to each other, writing a book with my teacher, Alan Finger, about meditation. So more about that as it gets closer to publishing. All right. So I'm going to pause for 1 second, then I'm going to come back and talk a little bit about process. You can find out all about what I'm up to at peterfurco.com, but I can also tell you right here, I am teaching class at Ishta Yoga in New York City, just south of Union Square on 11th Street. You can check that out at ishtayoga.com. I teach asana class, meditation class, and I'm teaching a teacher training that's starting next weekend. So if you've been thinking, man, I'd really like to do teacher training, you can. Come check it out, and we'll see you there. Here, there, or the other place. And if you'd like to find out about when we're doing our next retreat, like our fantastic retreat to Normandy that just ended, head on to peterfurco.com and sign up for the mailing list. I almost never send email. I have to get better about that. But when I do, I'll let you know about upcoming events. All right? Let's get back to my conversation with the butterflies in the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. Here we go. So how to use writing or creativity and the primary reasons I put out there earlier in the podcast were, it gives you a chance to put some perspective around something that's going on. So you can sort of take it out of yourself and look at it, frame it, play it out, change something and play it out that way, see how that goes. So there's that. Gives you a chance to take a step back and look at something, gain perspective, see more clearly. So there's that. And then there's the element of falling in love with the thing, that you make something, and then through the creating process, and my strong intuition is that we are literally co-creating what goes on here as part of the force of consciousness that powers the universe, right? So when you take on that role, and again, the creation can be of any nature, even creating a good relationship with your child, right? When you engage in those actions, the thing that you're making is aligned with your purpose. And the more it feels right, the more it's probably aligned with your own karma, that you're doing the thing you should be doing. And as you do those things, you end up making objects, moments, relationships that you fall in love with. And that love is, again, another indicator of you being aligned, you being in harmony. So those are two gigantic values to being creative, to allowing yourself to take this other kind of activity, slightly different from the way we normally take activity, and to engage in that doing something for its own sake. Yeah, so even though I just gave you two reasons, you can't go in and say, now I'm going to replay my options, or now I'm going to create something beautiful. You can try, but usually those are not very exciting things. In his book, Steal Like an Artist, Austin Kleon said, pay attention to your side projects. That's where the real juice is. I'm paraphrasing. But, you know, it's the stuff that you don't do for any value, where you allow yourself to simply express, to simply be. That it's that kind of action, that doing it for no reason, other than you feel kind of blossoming for it, right? Like I'm sitting by a bunch of flowers right now. So you're blossoming just for the blossoming, right? None of these flowers is competing with the other. It's just being what it is. And it's beautiful. It smells delicious. It looks so pretty, right? And then it comes and it goes. And that's all it is. So one of the items that came up on our retreat was this distinction between the process and the product, right? Because especially if you're a creative professional, you need products, because then you sell the product of your creativity. But the creativity is often, it's enough just to have done the process of the making, right? That's where so much of the magic is. And then the object, you can be in love with it like it's something that reminds you of what that process was. Or sometimes it's even something unto itself. Like I often think about songwriters who make a song and, you know, maybe their voice wasn't quite the perfect match for this song they wrote, but then some other singer picked it up and made it this gigantic hit, and now you always associate it with that other singer, you know? So like the object sort of has its own life. But the making can be the whole thing. So you don't have to get too precious about what came of it. And sometimes crap comes from it, but the process was so good. Yeah. So when you have an opportunity or a pull or a drive or like a playfulness, let that occur, right? Allow it to be. Let it be a part of who you are. In her book, The Artist's Way, Julia Cameron suggests a few different tools for allowing you to get into that mode and to stay in that mode. One of them is to write every morning. She calls it artist's pages. So you could take on a practice like that, a kind of a journaling kind of practice. But her emphasis in that is when you're stuck, when you're trying to write something and it seems like you don't have anything to write, just do it anyway. Stop being so critical of the thing. Allow stuff to flow. The process, again, process of writing. So there's that. She also recommends a thing called artist date, to go out and do things that inspire you. You know, go to the museum, go for a walk in Brooklyn Botanic Garden, go see a movie, go to the theater. If your thing is cooking, go to a great restaurant once in a while and just like enjoy the flavors and notice the interesting aspects of the menu. Again, you have to adapt it to your own self so you get in harmony with what feels good for you. But indulging your own creative spark will let you have access to this tool in your life. And what you do in one realm will totally impact what happens in another realm. This is basically the story of my life. From the perspective of like books on how to succeed, I'm like utterly a failure because I constantly flit from one thing to another thing. And yet I do it because I'm constantly after that feeling of what's inspiring me, where is it pulling me, what's the pure joyfulness component, And when I start getting bogged down in, oh my God, now there's this like administrative thing that you have to do, part of me takes it on as kind of, you know, you have to live in the world. So I'm doing that aspect of it. But also, it's not about that for me. You know, I can survive not being this thing. It's become clear to me that my karma doesn't lie in that direction. So you have to sort that out for yourself, right? When you do something, though, that's helping you be creative somewhere, when you go to the other things that you do, that muscle will have been flexed, right? And so you'll find creative solutions are presenting themselves. And those kinds of shifts are energetic. So they're not necessarily even explicit. They're not necessarily even evident. But you might find 6 months from now that, oh my God, look at how my life has shifted. I was looking for a new thing to do, and now look what I'm doing. Or something like that. Okay? So there's that. There's the playfulness. Other things about process. One of the ones that I think is really important is to allow yourself to be engrossed in the thing that's exciting for you. I had this experience completely where I was so in love with the characters I was writing that I just couldn't wait to get back to the book and reread what I had just written. And that always inspired me to write what was next. So, you know, the feeling, this deep feeling of love and compassion, Love Song, when I read through Love Song, I'm always crying by the end of it. It's like almost weird, you know, but there's something in it that is tugging at me, that is pulling and saying, you know, this is where you want to spend your time. When I was reading Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert, she wrote a section that said, fall in love with your creativity, which is along these lines. She said, you know, if you ever have an affair, or, you know, I'm not encouraging having affairs, but if, like, when you were a teenager and you were first in love, it's like anything you could do to have minutes with that object of your love, you would take it, you know? So it's like, can you cultivate that same appreciation for using creativity and bringing that component into your life so that there's this spark that's making you feel alive. As small as it is, right? Minutes stolen in a stairway, you know, with your junior high sweetheart. So that kind of thing. So hopefully that's some good food for thought about how writing might help you. And if writing isn't your thing, how doing something else that lets you play with that creative side of yourself. And, you know, I want to emphasize, I'm not talking about, you know, go be an artist, you know, go compete with Meryl Streep or anything like that. Just allow yourself to be the creator that you are. When I was giving a lecture in France, I began it by saying our nature is creative. You know, ever since the beginning of time, when humans needed to do something, they made it up, right? After it stopped being hunter-gatherer, and even during hunter-gatherer, you needed something to carry the things you gathered, and you needed some tools to hunt with, we made them up. We're creative by nature. And so you're creating every day in the way you organize your workspace, your desk, in the way that you organize your kitchen, in the place you choose to put your dishes, in the clothes that you choose to put on. We're always creating. That's enough creativity to deal with, to work with, right? So when you allow yourself to be creative in that way, to tap into it, you get these benefits of creating some perspective, perhaps explicitly playing something out, or perhaps just letting the energy move so that when you next encounter something, you're shifted, you're changed, you're enriched. And then through that enriching, now things are going to look different. You're going to take actions that are more in harmony with your karma. You'll make the right actions in the world that let you change the world in the ways that you're supposed to, the ways that are in your mission. And ultimately, life will feel more colorful. It will smell better. It will look more interesting. It will sound more interesting. And you'll be intrigued by other people who are creative in their ways. And that ends up becoming compassion. You start to understand what's going on when people are doing things that are different from you, because you're doing something different from what you did the day before, because now you're creative about it. And allowing that to flow. So, I hope you have a creative week. It's been lovely being in the garden and thinking of all of you listening wherever you do your listening, whether it's on a train or in a house or looking out at an ocean or being in your own green space. So have a lovely day, a lovely week. Namaste. That's it for this week's Peter's Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please check me out on patreon.com. Support the podcast at any level that makes sense to you. And we'll see you next time. Namaste.